Hello and welcome to podcast number 2 from The Professor Is In. I'm Kel Weinhold.
And I am Dr. Karen Kelski. And we are very happy to be here with you today.
The topic of today is publishing and toxic comparison and how they tend to, one tends to feed the other.
So, as you know, publishing is a reality of the academic career. There is no way to have an academic career and not put your work out in published form. That's actually how scholars conduct the work. That's how the work gets out there into the public space. That's why it's publication in the public space where ideas are read and debated and critiqued in some cases. And the sum of human knowledge moves forward. So if you are early in your career and you're having some weird feelings about publishing, just know this really is the core of what it is you sign up to do when you sign up to do an advanced degree and be a scholar.
And because, of course, this is all about academia, we have to qualify everything by saying that there are some colleges, community colleges, and some dwindling number of small liberal arts colleges that do not have the same kind of publishing pressure that larger universities do. But we have seen since the inception of The Professor Is In an increasing pressure on even community college faculty members to publish. So we don't expect that trend to diminish anytime soon.
Yeah. I mean, that gets into the whole issue of aspirational campuses. This is getting ahead of ourselves a little bit because I was just really trying to talk about the general principle of just wrapping your mind around the idea that publishing isn't kind of secondary consideration. It's right. A primary consideration. Right. I really want you to connect with your internal motivation for publishing. That's why I was starting where I did. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, The hard truth for many grad students is that your dissertation, which right now while you're in grad school feels like the be all and end all of your entire life, is actually just kind of a union card, and people don't read them. People don't read dissertations. Some of your committee is not even going to read your dissertation, frankly.
Don't tell them that.
And the thing is, the great work that you're doing isn't really going to move the field forward, and it isn't going to advance your career until it is out in published form. So you are, and with the job market the way it is, and it is absolutely, it's catastrophically bad, and we will talk about that over and over again in different ways, but the tenure track job market has imploded, and you can read much more about that in my book and on my blog. You do have to publish to be competitive on the academic job market at this point. So then it's a question of, well, what do you mean, Dr. Karen? Do I need one article? Do I need two? Well, I can't answer that. Nobody can tell you that. I just want you to look at the CVs of people close to your stage who are successful in your career, getting the kind of jobs that you're interested in, and see what they published when they were in grad school, and that'll be your answer. But the absolute norm, I mean, the one inviolable rule is it really has to be more than zero.
Right. And just as a caveat to what Karen said, you know, as you go out and start researching people's CVs, pay attention to what she said about people close to your finishing time. Don't be going out there and looking at CVs of old white guys and say, wow, I need to do that, because many of them did not have to publish at the level that you're going to be required to publish at. Mm-hmm. So you're going to want to look at people who got jobs a few years ahead of you, maybe people who just got tenure at a place that you want to be, and really look at what their publication record is. And I would say, I don't know, Karen, if you would agree with this, that the idea of even having something published before you go on the job market is relatively new. It's a 2 or 3 year old issue. Or do you think it's longer than that?
No, it was true when I was on the market in 1996.
That you had to have you had to have an article.
Oh yeah. Huh. No question.
Huh. Well, see, show up here, you learn something new every day.
Yeah, and I mean, and so just going back to what you said earlier, Kel, is that the number and kinds of schools that expect that has only increased. And so because even really low ranking institutions are experiencing credential creep and expectation creep, and they're what we call aspirational campuses, where, you know, 10, 15 years ago, they couldn't expect to hire people with a robust publishing record. But now, because the market is what it is, they've gotten rather greedy. And so they, too, are expecting publications for hire and much more robust publications for tenure compared to what the current faculty there ever were confronted with.
Sure.
So upshot, you're in a world where publishing is the name of the game. It's the gold standard. It's the currency. And both in terms of external expectations and internal, you know, we hope your internal motivation to get your ideas out there. And certainly for tenure, all universities are going to expect some level of publication, greater or lesser degree, depending on the kind of university. And not just the number, let's not just fetishize the number, but also what kind of publication? Is it a book chapter or a peer-reviewed journal article? Because those are not weighed equally at all. And short answer, the peer-reviewed journal article is weighed much more heavily than a book chapter because it's peer-reviewed and book chapters are much less peer-reviewed. And, you know, book reviews or encyclopedia entries, those, you know, barely count at all as publications. So you really want to be strategic about that. And the professor is in, on my blog and in my book, I have spent, you know, a decade writing about all of that. We don't need to really rehash all of that here today, right? Right, Kel?
Right.
We don't need to rehash all of that, do we?
I don't think we need to rehash all of that. So I was just sitting here thinking this question comes up a lot. The question of, do I need to publish? How much do I need to publish? We hear it a lot from people who are just going on the job market. And no matter how many times Karen raises the banner or beats the drum or insists, your chances are improved dramatically if you have publications. People want publications. Even the small campuses now want publications. We'll get pushback when we hear from my advisor said this or my, or the people who got hired last year didn't have that. Or I have a friend who got hired at an R1 and she didn't have that. And yes, you're going to always find exceptions. Mm-hmm. You need to ignore your advisor, but around this subject, but you're going to always find exceptions. So what we're trying to tell you is that to put yourself in the best possible position, especially if you want to be in an R1, but just in general, the best possible position. These departments need to know you can do your job. Mm-hmm. It's a ton of money to hire you. So that means that they need to know that you can get it together to get something published. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're talking about, is that they're, you can come up with all sorts of reasons that you don't have to.
Oh, sure.
And we can come up with one single reason that you do have to. It improves your chances and it proves you can do the job.
Right.
And who are you going to hire? The person who's proven they can do the job or not?
And if you have, if you're indulging in the rationalization that I write about in my book about, oh, I just want a small teaching job. I'm not ambitious. Reputation and money don't matter to me. I'll be happy with any little job. Well, you know, first of all, I could build a whole wing on my house, you know, if I had a nickel for every time someone said that. And the second thing is that that's just delusional right now, because like we said, even the quote unquote small little teaching jobs require publications, and even the small little teaching jobs are incredibly competitive, and you are competing against people who have robust publication records, and the institutions know that. And even though they will certainly be prioritizing teaching, because you know they might be a teaching focused campus, they're not going to ignore your academic record, your publishing record. So just be aware, you know, that they're really, as much as I know you and your advisor might want to live in a 1965 fantasy that it's only the great ideas that matter and not bean counting publication. Nevertheless, you know, that's terribly outdated and very, very dangerous for anyone who's interested in an academic career and looking for an academic job right now.
And let me just add one little other bit of evidence. I am in charge of the interview prep for the professors in, which means I do face-to-face interview preparation with people for the Skype interview, for the campus visit, and for the job talk. And one of the biggest shifts I've seen, and this is kind of why I said in the last 2 to 3 years, because I've seen this shift in that time, that places that would never have asked the question, tell us about your research, places that were clearly hiring you for a teaching position, mm-hmm. 4-4 load, not an elite Slack, but just a small regional university or a small liberal arts college that's regionally focused, that question, tell us about your research, has crept into the interview questions quite dramatically in the last couple of years. So when I first started off, we never even bothered to prep that question if you were going to go apply for some small regional or small community college, because it just never got asked. And it's now I have to prep everybody because your research is going to be part of the question. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where my 2 to 3 years thing came in, is it's really showing up in job interviews.
Yep. For sure. All right. So we have talked to you about how publications matter. And by the way, I would be remiss if I didn't say that peer-reviewed journal article, sole author, first author, those are the one, those are the in reasonably high-ranking journals, that's the gold standard. That's what you're aiming for. If you are in the humanities, they are going to expect a monograph. And so if you're in grad school, no, your book's not finished. You're still writing your dissertation. Yeah, of course, that's normal. But are they going to want to see a proposal maybe? Or know that you at least have an idea for the proposal and a timeline, and maybe you've talked to some editors at a conference. Yeah, they are going to want to see that. So all of that is just basic publishing 101. And like I said, you know, you can get way more information about all of that in my book and the blog and all sorts of other places.
And also, you want to be sure and email us at tnl@theprofessorsin.com. And we can take a look at any questions that you have for the podcast as well. If this brings up questions for you that you can't find on the blog or in the book, feel free to email us and we can always bring them up as a topic the next time around.
Oh, absolutely. We want your feedback about this podcast. Mm-hmm. We're just getting this off the ground. We can go in so many different directions and we just want to make it useful to you, our listeners. And so we are all ears. Please use any of our methods of contact. You know how we are on social media, Facebook, Twitter, whatever. Say, hey, I have an idea for the podcast. We will welcome that with open arms.
But in the meantime, I want to make a little switch here. So we talked to you about in the first couple of, or the first episode and in the trailer, we've talked to you about sort of Karen and my different roles. She's kind of the person that puts the fear of God in you. And I'm the person who comes afterward and says, breathe. Mm-hmm. So I just want to take a minute right now and tell you all to breathe, that you just heard 10 plus minutes of us talking about how you have to publish, you must publish. And that's the drumbeat that gets in your head from the time you start in the academy. And while that is true, there is no doubt that you need to publish. One of the things that can get in the way of that, and I talk about this when I'm working with people on productivity, is, and in my Unstuck, the Art of Productivity program, I talk about how comparison, i.e. competition, gets in the way of your productivity. Mm-hmm. How, and we talked about this last week, talking about comparison and is the thief of joy, and my favorite Teddy Roosevelt quote, and that really looking at comparison in a couple of ways, but the one I want to talk to right now is comparing yourself or your production or what you're doing to what you believe other people are doing.
Right. So basically, let's just, you know, we're pivoting from the stressful idea, you know, that I have just now induced in you that, oh my God, I have to publish. Dr. Carrot said I have to publish. And then realizing, you know, just all the ways that then freezes people in this kind of immobilized terror, that it instantly morphs not from the internal motivation, which is where I tried to start today, and gets into that external motivator of, oh my God, well, so-and-so is doing it, and so-and-so is doing it, and so-and-so expects to see it, and my advisor expects to see it. And suddenly you have lost your own inner
agency.
You've lost your agency. Yeah, exactly.
You've turned it over to somebody else.
And so that's why this episode's called Publishing and Toxic Comparison, because we really want to like dig into that and help you. And Kel's program, all the insights that she's achieved and incorporated into her Unstuck coaching are really about this.
Right.
So
if you want to, let's just stop a minute and sort of cast your mind back. It may not have to be very far. You may be there right now, but into graduate school and into your classes and where you went from feeling like you were getting smarter and you knew enough to not enough. And not enough by definition is compared to something else. Mm-hmm. You can't have enough or not enough unless you're comparing it to something. So this question, this comparison thing starts very, very early. I've heard Karen say before that maybe in your first year of your master's, you feel like you're learning something and you're getting smarter. And then there becomes this pivot where you start to feel like you're not learning anything.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, you feel like you're learning something, but the longer you're in graduate school, the less you know.
Right.
So you start out your first year of your master's program and you think, hey, I'm a really smart person and I'm a really good student and I'm a good writer and I love to read and I'm thinking great thoughts and I have so much to contribute. And then 5 years later, you're done with your PhD and you're like, I know nothing. Right. I am a worthless worm.
Right.
And I, you know, it's like the grad school. Remember last week's episode, we were talking about the cult. I mean, it is an indoctrination process, mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, that's sort of, I mean, it's not explicitly trying to make you feel ignorant. It isn't. It's trying to train you in a discipline. But somehow the toxic way it does it leaves so many people, and especially if you're not a cisgender white male, but someone who's coming from a marginalized position, it's so brutalizing that it leaves you by the end of it just feeling like an imposter mm-hmm. and like everybody else is smarter than you and is writing more than you and you don't belong and you're a fraud and they're going to find out.
Right. So let's look at the way that those start to develop. Let's start mm-hmm. with graduate school, right? And you start reading. And like Karen said, initially, you feel like I'm so smart and I'm learning so much stuff. But then you're reading along and you read somebody and you understand them and you make some comment about it. And somebody else says, oh, yeah, so-and-so said that in her article, or so-and-so said that in the work that precedes this. And you have that moment of like, oh, shit, there's stuff out there I don't know. I don't know. And it somehow gets automatically transferred into I don't know enough. It doesn't stay in this place of curiosity like, mm-hmm. Wow, I've never read that person. I'll go read that person now. Instead, because it's such a sort of closed system, and once you, in trying to discipline you into belonging, there's that moment of feeling shoved outside of the group because you hadn't read some previous stuff. So the first place it happens is in graduate school. I should be reading all the time. I haven't read enough.
And what your trigger point is, oh, you haven't read that?
Yeah, I hate that sentence.
Oh, you haven't read that?
Oh, man, that just annoys the... just this condescending crap. Right. If you're doing that to people, stop it. Mm-hmm. And if somebody does it to you, just walk away.
Right. Know that it's a power move.
It's a power move.
And it's obnoxious.
And I know that sometimes people
And it's
just,
shaming.
Yeah, it is. And I know that sometimes people just say it like observationally, like, oh, you haven't read that? But there's no way that observing, making observations about other people does not end up shaming for a lot of people. So mm-hmm. just keep your comments about things to be about you would be helpful.
So I just want to go back to just like restate that what, or like it's reframe what you said earlier. You said, you discover there's a thing you don't know, you haven't read. And it isn't like, oh, I haven't read that. I'm going to go get it out of the library now and read it. It morphs into, oh, I haven't read that. I'm a fraud. I don't belong.
Mm-hmm. Or it ends up in overwork. You do exactly what you just said. You go to the library and get all the books and you have to stay up and read them all. And you never go out to a drink with anybody or mm-hmm. out to a movie or I'm sorry, I can't. I have to read this stack of library books that I haven't yet to open. And when you leave, I'm not going to open anyway. But I have them all here because of my anxiety that I don't know enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get started really early in this not only culture of not enough, but this culture of foregoing balance mm-hmm. and your whole life to try to be enough.
Right.
So the first thing I wanted to touch on is just being able to track where that starts to happen, right? Starts to happen with the reading. Then we write something and we miss a key thing and somebody points it out and says, hey, you haven't read enough on that. You need to read that. We take that as shaming instead of informational or just guidance, which it is. Hey, yeah, I should read that. You're right. And then we think, well, if there was a blank spot there, there may be a blank spot in 40 other places I don't recognize. So I better gather all the books and I better take all the classes and I better do all the stuff. And pretty soon your motivation is no longer curiosity. It's no longer internal desire. It's trying to escape shame.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to escape somebody yep. finding out,
right.
quote unquote, that you don't know something.
Exactly.
Instead of accepting, of course, I don't know everything.
Right.
There is not a way that you can know everything.
Right. You can't.
Right.
And, you know, and this also goes into not just the reading. We've been talking a lot about that, but it's also the writing. So, you know, you start with a cohort and then suddenly it seems like they have gotten 3/4 of their dissertation done and you have barely even started, or they have an article out and you don't have it out yet. And then it goes if you're on the tenure track and then suddenly, you know, your friend and, you know, at the other institution has published, or your friend down the hall has published 4 articles, and you're still trying to get your first one out. And I haven't written enough. I haven't written enough. I haven't read enough. I haven't applied for enough grants. I haven't gone to enough conferences. I haven't been invited to enough keynote addresses.
And you get, and in the process of that, you forget all the details that inform that, right? You start comparing their outsides to your insides. And so you're inside a mess and something's going on. And maybe you're, maybe you have actual things getting in the way of that work, right? Maybe your expectation for publication has to be different because you have small kids at home, or you have a chronic illness, or you have family that you need to go visit regularly for whatever reason, or maybe you're the financial support for your family. All of those things that chip away at the time we have to publish, instead of correcting and saying, well, this is actually how much time I have, and this is a reasonable expectation for me in my life. Instead, what we do is say, oh, well, that person over there is doing all of this. I'm not, therefore, I'm a mess. They're not a mess. First of all, you don't know if that person over there with those 4 publications is a mess or not. So assuming that they're not struggling is a mistake.
Right.
We also don't know what their external workload is separate from the academy.
Right.
I don't know anything about
like what their home life is like and how much laundry and cooking they have to do. And let me also say, this is a really, really good moment to bring up something that we try to highlight at every moment that we can at The Professor Is In. You may well be a person who is traumatized by your own research. What I mean by that is, if you are a scholar of color and you are researching the history of slavery, or you are looking at violence against your community, discrimination, you know, demographic information about the suffering and the illness, environmental racism. I mean, you know, the list is endless. If you are a woman researching sexual assault, these are just examples. I mean, honestly, it is an endless number of possibilities. You are not neutral. These are not neutral things to you, topics or processes. And so you don't walk in there, you don't walk in and out of the archive unscathed. And you don't, and some of this writing is drawing blood from you as you write. And so there will be other people who for whom that's not the case. And when you look at the question of, wow, they seem to be able to write so much more, they might be in a very different position vis-a-vis their research topic than you are. And that also has to be considered.
Absolutely. And I think whether it's the topic itself, whether you're writing on things that are painful, one of the scholars I know writes on gun violence. And so every time there's yet another mass shooting in the United States, it sets her back on her ass and she has to kind of collect herself to be able to keep doing that work. So I think there's that. But I also think, you know, barring any kind of content in your research, there's also just simply, we all work at different paces. We all do different things. And if we keep comparing ourselves to what someone else is doing, we never get actually usable and valuable information, right? Because those people, we don't actually know what their process is. We don't know how much they struggle. We don't know what they have going for them. We could sit in a corner and resent them. So remember how I said comparison is the thief of joy? So you sit over here and you resent that person because they have more support than you do. Mm-hmm. They don't have the same limitations that you do. So your joy is gone. You're spending your time in resentment, right? So And it's the other way around, too. You know, if you're actually accomplishing stuff and you see somebody not getting as far, if the little snotty part of you comes out and is thinking, wow, I have more publications than he does, you're taking your own joy. You're moving out of the joy of the experience and into somebody else's lane. So there's that first thing of just coming to understand, this is how much I can do. I want you to, in that, take a minute and begin to think about where you have started following someone else's path and not your own. And you can do that pretty easily by starting to listen to the narratives that are going on in your head about what's not enough, right? So I haven't written enough today. Mm-hmm. I haven't published enough. I don't understand this well enough. I haven't read enough. And just do this little test. Ask yourself who's talking and who it benefits. Whom it benefits.
Interesting.
right? So if you're saying, I'm not publishing enough, who's talking?
Well, what do you mean, who's talking?
Because it's typically informed by some voice. You know how Martha Beck talks about, you know, write down your everybody sentence. Everybody thinks I'm. And then write down who your everybody is.
It's usually one to two people.
Usually three people. Mm-hmm. It's just like some early educator.
Yeah.
Some parent and some current nemesis.
Right.
It's like you pick these three categories.
Right.
And your nemesis may actually be a relative, but it's still, it's like we have these wounds from our early education. Like in fifth grade, my teacher said I was never going to amount to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And some family member who is overbearing or judgmental, or we at least read it that way. And then somebody in our current life that we're in a battle with. And a lot of times that's somebody in your cohort.
Mm-hmm.
So then if you do that, then you realize your everybody is three people.
Right.
So you're in the lie of everybody when it's three people and the other however many billion people are on the planet don't even care. Right. So get in a little bit of perspective here. Right.
Right? Right.
So that's where those narratives can start, is when we start thinking I'm not good enough in comparison. And typically it's fed by somebody else's voice. And then if you are struggling with writing and you're saying, I'm not good enough, my CV isn't good enough. And I ask you, who benefits from you telling yourself that?
Mm-hmm.
Who benefits from that? Because it's not you. Let me be really clear that negative motivation only works for so long. And I find a lot of people that I work with sort of grew up in a negative motivation household, and they got through the first part of their PhD, their first part of their job is using that negative motivation.
Right.
And then they're like every other sentient being, that if you keep whipping it, eventually it quits or it turns on you.
Right.
And you suddenly can't use all the tools that you had before, and you're stuck. So the first place is to back off and say, where am I beating myself up for not being enough?
Yep.
Because that's when the enough becomes a sort of toxic.
Right. And what you usually say also is grasping that these are stories.
Oh, yeah.
That this is that. So, I mean, this is really only a rephrasing of what you just said, but they in different words. But they're stories.
Right.
So you have created a story that they are doing so much, you're doing so little. You're a failure. They're so much more deserving. And none of it is based in reality, because you don't really know the complete reality. You just know a few little fragments. But basically, you're using the story to construct a narrative about how you're a failure.
Right.
And
so why not construct a story that supports you?
Right.
Right. Is there anything wrong with writing? If you're going to make shit up,
right,
make shit up that supports you. That's sort of where that who's benefiting from this comes from. So if you're making up a story that says I don't write enough, I want to know who that benefits. It certainly doesn't benefit you.
Mm-hmm.
And what if you turned around and said, you're doing a great job. You're writing enough. Just keep
going.
You're
writing enough. Yeah. It's you're using your imagination. You are using your imagination to create.
You're already creating
this
fiction.
To create fiction.
Just create some more.
Create different fictions.
Exactly.
Create the fiction.
Exactly.
You know what? I just read an article. I didn't actually read it today. I just skimmed it, but I'm going to go back and read it. It was posted by someone I love on Facebook, and it was about exalting the fat body.
Mm.
And it wasn't just, and it was taking a step further. It wasn't saying, don't just accept your fat body or tolerate your fat body or defend your fat body. None of, you know, that's kind of where most of us get stuck. Those of us who think about these things. But it was like, no, actually, you know, heap praise and delight on your fat body and exalt your fat body. What would you do if you just, you know, covered it in glorious clothes and or whatever else, jewels or jewelry or praise or made beautiful art about it? What if you did all of those things that we do that we think the thin body is worthy of, but we just did it without question for the fat body? Anyways, that's an example. That's the same thing. It's imaginative work, but we're taking it to the thing that is supposedly abject, but we're actually making a new story about that thing. And that's really what we're asking you to do, is create a new story. And, you know, the thing is that the bad story is demotivating, like Kel said. It's causing you stress. It's causing you to overwork. It's causing you to have bad boundaries and probably not make great choices about various things like, I don't know, work-life balance.
Right.
things like that.
Right.
So you're actually the bad, you know, the negative story is not probably motivating you to do your best work. And certainly it can't do that indefinitely.
Right. So just to wrap up, what we're asking you to do is as you step into the reality of publishing, which is the reality of the Academy, which is that you do need to publish. And when that publishing begins to move into a fear, place of fear, a place where you're freezing and not getting it done, or a place where you're causing yourself pain in the process. And by what I mean is the way that you're talking to yourself, the way that you're talking about yourself, you wouldn't allow any adult to talk to a child that way. You're your best friend. You're still the kid inside of you. So how do you figure out how to change the language to be more supportive? The first thing that you do is understand that your sense of not enough was cultivated. That it began, who knows when, but certainly in graduate school it was cultivated. You haven't read enough. You haven't written enough. You haven't worked enough. And understand all of those as a system that is trying to put everything off on you and not accept you as the individual. So if you begin to accept you for who you are and say, this is really what I'm capable of, this is really what I'm willing to do, then you can start to shift your comparison from other people to yourself.
Yeah.
Then you could say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to do this much and then do it. And then when you get to the next day, you can look back and say, look, I did that yesterday.
I did that.
Right.
And yeah, that was more than I did the day before. That I have more now than I had the day before. Even if it's only a couple of sentences, it's mm-hmm. more. Or maybe all I didn't actually get to write, but I cleaned up my bibliography. Made my citations consistent. And that's something that I was able to do. And so basically your comparator is no longer external, it's internal. You're just saying, I've done more than I know more than I did yesterday. I've read more than I had read yesterday.
And just to add a little caveat there, because I think it can be really easy to narrow down what is acceptable. So you can compare to yourself and say, well, I wrote yesterday and I didn't write today. But you fail to mention that you taught three classes
right.
or you designed a new syllabus.
Or you got the flu.
Oh, yeah. The number of academics who are like, I was home all week sick. I should have gotten some work done.
Exactly.
What? Well, I get so confused.
I know.
Well, you know, here's one of my favorites. I set up, I planned to work 4 hours yesterday and I didn't do it. So today I'm going to work 8. I just want you to pause with the logic of that. 4 was too much, so I'll double it.
Exactly.
Right? That's the not enough mentality.
Right.
Instead, as, whoa, 4 was too much. How can I shrink down till I get to the point that I'll do it and then just do it every day?
Mm-hmm.
Get down to what works for you.
Every day that it is doable.
Every day that it's doable.
When I'm not sick.
Or when I'm taking the weekend off.
Right.
Right. So I should be clear. I don't mean 7 days a week.
All of the valid reasons there are when... And that's a subject for another podcast,
right.
But you can do all of this writing 15 minutes a day. And this is true. And we're going to tell you how some at another podcast pretty soon. But this is not none of what we're talking about in terms of effective productivity requires more than about that.
Right.
So just to wrap up, I just want to say that while you're thinking about all these publishing goals that we've talked about and that I write about, just remember the whole Academy is based on external validation, and external validation is a game that cannot be won because there's never an end to it. There's always someone else who you're going to look at and say, well, they write more, they know more. So basically what we're saying is just reclaim it for yourself. Internal validation, that is, knowing that you yourself are on a path, you're on a journey, you know more than you did yesterday, and that is something that you can always, always access, is always available to you.
Yeah, basically, you're enough.
You're enough.
We'll see you next time.